across the ether at the speed of light. It's the Mortgage Moment with Mark Wells of Preferred Financial. My friends tell me I have a face for radio. And Carrie Deese, Ninja Processor, fending off those evil underwriters who want to turn your loan down. Join us for the next hour as we take a look at the ins and outs of closing costs and interest rates in the mortgage process. Carrie, probably one of the most common questions that I get is, so how much will my closing cost be?
Mm-hmm.
And it's always been floating out there that there's a rule of thumb, and it's about 3%. Is the rule of thumb valid?
Not really.
Yeah, there are many fixed costs in a mortgage transaction, and those fixed costs are independent of the size of the loan. And so you can have a small loan with, for instance, the appraisal. The appraisal is the same generally for a $50,000 house as it is for a $250,000 house. And so the percentage doesn't hold true. A lot of people have heard 3% use that as a figure. I would say, you know, if your loan's in the 200,000 range, that's probably legitimate.
But sure.
As a percentage, it's not going to be too accurate. We have to get down to specifics. So we have documents that we show the borrowers ahead of time when we're discussing their mortgage. And then when they engage the mortgage process, we have a formal document now. It's called, let's see, the last iteration is what, an LE?
Yep, the loan estimate.
The loan estimate. And in true government fashion, and all of you government lovers will enjoy this, we used to have a single fee sheet that outlined every closing cost, specified exactly what it is, and evidently that was confusing everybody because it listed every single cost line by line. And so the government, in order to protect you, in order to make things perfectly clear, replaced our one-page fee sheet with, I think it's a five-page LE.
Oh, you're forgetting the two-page good faith estimate that came after the one page.
That's right.
And
I
now
one.
It's been expanded to five pages.
We had the fee sheet. We went to the good faith estimate. And now we need five pages to tell you what we used to tell you in one page.
Yep.
Which is why the general application package that used to be like 12 pages, I think, when I started in 1989, you could do a mortgage disclosure with 12 pieces of paper. Now, what do we get into? 40? 50 pages, maybe?
If the lender doesn't have an e-sign process, it's probably 50 pages that you'd have to print and sign.
Unbelievable. And heaven help you if you ever want a reverse mortgage.
Oh,
the last
goodness.
Reverse mortgage package I printed was 117 pages.
Yeah, we measure those in inches instead of pages.
What we do is we just weigh it, and if it weighs enough, you're in. So if we don't have a rule of thumb about closing costs, we need to talk about, in particular, the type of closing costs you'll encounter in your mortgage transaction. The new LE will group them into some odd categories, but nevertheless, the first category you'll see on your LE is origination charges. Carrie, what constitutes origination charges?
The fee that you pay to us for our services.
And what do we call that?
The origination fee.
You got it. And it can also include discount points, which are optional in any transaction. What else included in the origination charges?
If there was a processing fee, that would be considered a part of that as well.
And then the lender's underwriting fee is a part of that. So you may see three or four different specific charges under the category origination charges, the origination fee, discount points, underwriting fee, any processing fees. We get questions a lot from people, Carrie, who ask, well, should I pay a point? And they usually say, so how much is a point? So to answer their question of how much a point is, what is it?
A point would be 1% of the loan.
That's correct. So if you had a $100,000 loan, your one discount point would be $1,000. $200,000 loan, your discount point is $2,000. And discount points are used to buy down the rate on a loan. So the question is, well, hey, that's a good thing. I get a better rate. But the real answer to whether you should do that or not is to do a cost analysis. And you have to ask yourself, first of all, why would a lender let you buy the rate down? Why would they take money and then give you a better rate? Well, that's because Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, and VA have been keeping loan statistics for going on 70 years. And even though you have taken out a 30-year loan, the average lifespan of that loan is only about 65 months. Oddly enough, a 15-year loan has a longer average lifespan than the average 30-year loan. And that's because people generally refinance to get a better rate, better payment. They may refinance to get rid of PMI. They move and they sell their house. For whatever reason, the longest average that a 30-year loan will be in place is 65 months. So if you take the discount point that you're paying and you calculate how much that saves you in monthly payment, what you find is that the lender has pre-collected the 65 months of interest difference from you up front. Now, that can be fine. In other words, if you pay the discount points, it takes you 65 months to recover in lower payment what you paid to get the lower payment. So your decision as to whether you should pay a discount point has to do with how long you think you'll live in the home or how long you think you might go before you might refinance. I always say that's a difficult decision. I do not usually encourage paying discount points because I think for the most part we all become statistics. And we might, maybe if it's your last house, your retirement house, you know you're going to be there for the next 25, 30 years, maybe that's a good time to engage and pay a discount point. But generally, unless you've got an incentive package, a seller's paying it, I would say just go with the standard 1% origination fee and don't pay any discount points.
And a lot of times, you know, psychologically, we all think a lower rate is the most important thing you can do. But when you factor in the payment differential between the rate and the payment, sometimes it's not that big.
That's right. And, you know, it's a kind of a personal decision, but for instance, I would usually feel a little more comfortable instead of paying the money out for a discount point, just keeping that money in the bank, having a slightly higher payment, and then I got a little bit to fall back on.
Sure.
So there's not really a right or wrong decision here. It's really, you know, what you perceive your particular situation is. Pay the discount points, though, only if you know for certain you're going to be in that house longer than 5.5 years. Now, Carrie, we see underwriting fees and processing fees. We sometimes call these junk fees, but every lender has them.
Mm-hmm.
What is an underwriting fee, and why do they charge that?
An underwriting fee is just what you pay the lender for the process of underwriting your loan file.
That's right. When you submit a file, there's a human being doing the underwriting, and the backup and the staffing it takes to do those things, the lender recovers partially in their underwriting fee. There are the next category in your LE, your loan estimate, would be things called charges you may not shop for. And these are things that are required as part of the loan process, but you actually don't get a choice in who you use and who you get those from. For instance, one of those items is an appraisal fee. You do not get to select your appraiser, as we covered last week, any longer. Even the originator of your loan cannot select the appraiser. It has to be ordered blindly. So through a system that the originator does not know who is the one doing the appraisal. So the appraisal fee you can't shop for. That is, you can't choose your own provider of that service. What are some of the other charges, Carrie, that you cannot shop for?
There's always a flood certification fee that's usually between $9 and $12.
Yeah, it's no big deal. And a flood certification is actually a good thing. It allows you to purchase your home without having to get a survey to show where any potential floodplains are. Now, Carrie, if we do a flood certification, we're getting a certification from FEMA that the property does not lie in a flood zone. What happens if there is a flood zone on the property being purchased and the flood certification comes back to us and tells us that?
You'll just be required to obtain flood insurance for the flood zone that comes back on that flood certificate.
Right, in the different flood zones. And the cost of insurance, flood insurance, is mandatory if your house is in a flood zone. There is an exception if your foundation is above the 100-year flood line. You can get a waiver for flood coverage, but something you may want to get anyway. Flood zones change, so our flood maps change with time. And your flood certification will both assure your lender that they're protected, but also that you are in the event of a flood. When we get back from the break, we'll talk about more closing costs. Get a cup of coffee and join us. Thanks for hanging in there with us. Alice, wake up. Steve, we know you're out there lurking around and listening to us. We have verified now. I think we've got a dozen people that get up on Saturday morning. So I think our show must be waking people up. That's what I think it is.
We'll call that a win.
We will definitely chalk that up on the win category. We're talking about closing costs. Carrie, before we get into that, tell people how they can contact us if they have any specific questions or want specific quotes on their closing costs for their transaction.
You can give us a call Monday through Friday at 864-235-9596. You can email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com. And if you want to go back and listen to this show again or a former show, you can visit our website at preferredfinancialgreenville.com.
Terrific. Thanks. We were talking about items on the loan estimate that are charges that you may not shop for. These are mandatory items that must be part of your loan closing package, but you do not have the ability to select who the provider of these services is. We mentioned appraisal fees as one, flood certifications, which are done through FEMA. We have a tax service fee, and that normally runs $68 to $75, not a big thing. The tax service fee is what the county charges to either set up your property tax bill to go to your lender and to be paid by them, or to report that you have paid your property taxes if you are not escrowing. And finally, in these items, there is the credit report fee. And, Carrie, sometimes with credit reports, we see quite a spread of costs. Why would costs be different place to place and person to person for a credit report?
Well, like everything, costs increase over time. And we've pretty consistently seen every year 30 to 45 cent increases, which add up. So an individual borrower might expect to pay just for the flat credit report about $35. Joint borrowers is about $45. And anytime we have to update an account or anything like that, it's $10 per account. So sometimes if we have to go through a lot of updates on your report, if you've got multiple mortgages and we need to update the payments on those, I've seen them go up to $100, but that's kind of in a rare case.
And then occasionally, Carrie, with some particular account change, the borrower may want their credit report rescored.
Sure.
For instance, if you pay down revolving debt, generally speaking, your scores are going to go up because you lower your proportion of balance to credit limit. But when we rescore, what kind of charges do we encounter when we're trying to do a rescore?
Well, get ready. It's $35 per account, per bureau, plus the cost to rescore the, repull the report, rather.
Yeah, so that can add up quickly. Most accounts report to all three bureaus.
Right.
So if you're updating one account at $35 per bureau, and then you add the cost of the revised credit report itself, you can be to $150 just to rescore one account. But sometimes that's worth it. Sometimes that may save you a quarter in rate, and then you're saving money over the life of the loan. But you will see variations in credit report fees because of those things. The next big category in your loan estimate are attorney-related charges. In South Carolina, only a licensed attorney can close a mortgage loan, and there are costs associated with that. In North Carolina, title companies are allowed to close, and in Georgia also. In South Carolina, it has to be an attorney. So these fees, one way or the other, will come into the closing, whether it's actually an attorney doing it or a title company doing it. Let's talk about what those things are. What are some of the attorney-related charges, Carrie, that we find?
You'd have a title exam, title binder, the fee that the attorney charges to close the loan. That's usually between $375 and $475.
Mm-hmm.
Title insurance itself.
Right.
Deed prep and deed stamps or transfer taxes,
yeah,
which is always a big one.
That is a big one. So let's take them one at a time. A title exam is where an attorney goes into the public record and make sure that the title is clear. Why is that important, Carrie, that you be inheriting a clear title?
Well, you want to make sure that you do have full ownership rights of that property.
And you want to make sure that no one else has a lien on the property, because here's the problem. A lien transfers to you in the deed. So, for instance, let's say your seller had an IRS tax lien and your attorney failed to find that. Well, when you become the proud owner of that brand new house, you become the proud new owner of that person's tax lien.
Yep.
And it would be a bear to get it off, because that was the collateral that the IRS secured their lien with. There can be other types of liens and other types of clouds on title, other adverse claims that may have come up in a court of law. And so a title exam is the critical matter that has to be taken care of to make sure that you are getting a clear title and a serviceable title to the house that you're buying, and you're not taking on someone else's problems. Your title binder is kind of very similar to an insurance binder. It just assures the lender that a clear title will be issued and a title insurance policy can be issued on the house that's being purchased. The closing fees, as Carrie mentioned, can vary from attorney to attorney, usually $375 to $425. When we get to title insurance, Carrie, there are two different types of title insurance. What are they?
Well, there's the lender's coverage, which insures the lender up to the loan amount that you have obtained, and the owner's coverage, which secures you.
Okay, and lender coverage is mandatory. Mm-hmm. You have to have a lender title insurance policy. An owner's policy is optional. And let's talk just briefly for a minute about what title insurance actually does, because it's kind of a, you know, there are like five or six different insurances that can come into a mortgage transaction. This is an important one. Now, I've been doing mortgages for 29 years, and in that 29 years, I've only come across about seven or eight issues that triggered a title insurance claim. This is out of probably 10 to 12,000 transactions. So you would have to say in South Carolina, particularly, that title claims are fairly rare. However, if they occur, they're catastrophic. Because if there is a title insurance issue, there is an issue about whether you actually own the house that you thought you bought.
Mm-hmm.
There's either from a flaw in the title, or we had one instance where the attorney had drafted the deed incorrectly, and the man that we had helped with his purchase loan came back to refinance his house, and the attorney who did the title exam on the refinance found out, hey, you don't really own that house. You own the lot next to it. Well, that was a large title insurance claim. These things can usually be settled, but they're still a mess.
And they take a long time.
What other kind of title insurance issues might arise? Well, to be honest with you, Florida has one of the highest title insurance costs because they have the most title insurance claims, because most title insurance issues arise out of a state settlement. And here's what can happen. Uncle Benny dies, and he doesn't have any children, so he wills his farm to his six nieces and nephews. But he leaves two of his nieces and nephews out of that. Well, some years go by, and the nieces and nephews that own the old farm sell that to a developer and walk away millionaires. And then the two nieces and nephews that were left out of the will all of a sudden say, hey, you know, we got cut out of a will. I don't think he could cut us out, and we're going to challenge the will. So they go back and challenge the will. Well, that challenges the inheritance, which challenges their right to sell the property, which then affects the developer, and the developer has sold the lots to you. So there's a cloud on that title, and all of a sudden, the house you thought you were owning with no problems has a huge problem. This actually happened in a subdivision between Greenville and Spartanburg a number of years ago. And it took about 5 years. We had an almost impossible task of obtaining title insurance until this was settled, and it was an estate claim. Yeah, some of our listeners may remember the Catawba Indian claim. That came out of left field in the early 80s, in which the Catawba Indians decided that they were defrauded out of their ancestral lands. And they challenged the original taking of the land from their tribe. Well, that pretty much covered all of North Carolina and a lot of South Carolina. Rock Hill was affected by this, because what they were saying is, hey, you guys think you own this property? You don't. It belongs to us and to our ancestors. That was a giant title insurance issue. The federal government stepped in to settle that, because you can imagine the millions of people and, you know, probably tens of millions of pieces of property that were affected by that claim. And it would have, I'm sure, taken the title insurance companies down if they had to actually pay those claims. So the government settled that. But those are examples of title insurance claims that might come up. And you must have enough coverage to pay off the mortgage. If a title claim is adverse and is settled against you, the title insurance would pay off the mortgage balance. If you carry an owner's policy, which is optional, they would also pay you for your equity that you lost in that adverse title claim. So, I have people ask me, well, should I take out an owner's policy? Every attorney will tell you you should. I will tell you that it is highly unlikely you will ever have a claim, but if you ever did, it would be catastrophic. It is very inexpensive coverage. You pay it one time, and it's there for as long as you own the property. So, generally speaking, since you have to have a lender policy, just go ahead and pay the little bit of additional money for the owner's portion of that. After attorney fees, Carrie, in the LE, we have these things called prepaid items. What are prepaid items?
Prepaid items are things like interim interest, your taxes, your hazard insurance, things of that nature.
Okay, so prepaids are sometimes referred to as escrows, or although they include more than that. Technically, legally, your prepaid items are defined as your upfront homeowner's insurance premium. When you buy a house, your insurance has to be in effect when you buy the day you buy the house. And insurance is purchased in advance for a lot of obvious reasons. If we could purchase insurance after the fact, we would have a lot of people purchasing hurricane insurance right after the hurricane.
Oh, yes.
So the requirement on homeowner's insurance is that it be in effect. And you have to have a one-year paid-up policy the day you close. The policy is normally charged at closing, but that's one of your prepaid items. Escrow deposits. These are the amounts that your lender puts into your escrow account to pay your future bills of your property taxes, and then your renewal premium on your homeowner's insurance when it comes to you the following year. Typically on a purchase, you're contributing 2 months of property taxes. Your seller's going to contribute the number of months they have owned the property in the tax year. And then you're going to put 2 months of insurance in your escrow account, too. The last item is interim interest. I'll get into a little more in-depth explanation of what it is, but technically interim interest is the interest you pay at the closing of your loan that pays the interest for the month that you are closing in. It pays the number of days interest that accrues on your loan in the month that you close it. We'll talk about that in detail when we get back. Thanks for being with us, and we'll see you on the other side. With Mark Wells, Preferred Financial, and Carrie Deese. We're talking today about closing costs and interest rates associated with your mortgage transaction. If you need to have a specific question answered, give us a call Monday through Friday at 235-9596. That's 864-235-9596. I was talking about interim interest before the break. Interim interest is the interest you pay from the day of your closing through the end of the month you're closing in. So to minimize that, you would want to close on the last day of the month, and that's why everyone always says, hey, I want to close on the last day of the month. But let me explain what interim interest is, and then I think you'll see that it really doesn't matter. You could have two extremes in your closing. You could close, for instance, on May 31st. You're closing on the last day of the month. What do you owe? Well, you owe 1 day's worth of interest on your new loan. So your interim interest charges are 1 day, and that may be $18 or $20, depending on the size of your loan. But what if you close the next day on June 1st? Well, now all of a sudden you have 30 days of interim interest to pay, and that could be $500 or $600. So people say, well, I don't want to close on the 1st, but let me explain what happens. When you take out a mortgage loan and you make your regular payment, there are actually two ways the lender might structure that payment. You could either, with your payment, be paying interest in arrears, that is the interest that has accrued over the last 30 days, or you could be paying the interest that will be charged for the next 30 days or interest in advance. All mortgage loan transactions of standard Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA, VA, all of those programs pay interest in arrears, which means when you make your June 1st payment, technically you're paying May's interest and June's principal. When you pay the interim interest on May 31st, you do not have a June 1st payment the next day because May's interest has already been paid at closing. So that's why your interim interest charge is 1 day, but then your first house payment will be July 1st. It will be in 30 days. If you slide over to June 1st and you pay those 30 days worth of interim interest, which might be $500 or $600, well, you don't have a payment on July 1st. You actually go to August 1st. So in the two extremes, it really becomes six of one and a half dozen of the other. You can close towards the last day of the month and your first payment will be in about 30 days, or you can close right after the first of the month and your first payment will be in 60 days. In the end, it's kind of a wash, and it doesn't really matter. Carrie, we missed a couple of things when we were talking about attorney-related charges, and we failed to talk about deed prep and deed stamps. Deed prep is what the attorney charges to draft the new deed that transfers the property from your seller to you. Deed stamps are actually a tax on the transaction that the state charges. And it's $3.65 per $1,000 of purchase price. So a $100,000 purchase price has $365 in deed stamps. Who typically pays for the deed prep and the deed stamps in South Carolina and North Carolina, Carolina?
In North and South Carolina, typically, it is the seller who pays for those.
Okay. And the only thing I will do is warn our borrowers out there, our potential home buyers, that if you're dealing with a large national builder, you need to really scrutinize your contract, because they usually sneak in on page 25, section A, 3, 43, paragraph B, somewhere in there, that you, the buyer, are going to pay for the deed stamps. That can be an unexpected expense, because typically deed stamps are not disclosed in your preliminary disclosures. We have to have a contract to see who's going to pay it. 99% of the time in our states that are within our broadcast reach here, the seller is expected to pay those things, but we do find that the national builders charge the buyers for those things, and you have to factor that into your out-of-pocket expenses when you go to buy a house. We also fail to mention recording fees. Your transaction of a purchase and your closing of a mortgage is a public record. It's important that it's public, because other than that, it would not be enforceable and your right of ownership could be questioned. But because it's recorded, it's there for anyone to examine, everyone to see, and your right of ownership is protected. So recording fees are usually fairly nominal. I think, Carrie, they run about $25 for a deed, maybe $40 for a deed, and $25 for a mortgage, something like that. Isn't that right?
Yeah, you typically won't see higher than $50 in total at the end of the game.
So the main expense of the public transaction, the public part of the transaction, are the deed stamps, which, again, typically your seller is going to pay if you're using a standard state real estate contract for your closing. Let's talk about some goodies that might come along in the mortgage process, because so far we've talked about everything that is a charge. That is the things you're going to have to pay. Let's talk about credits. We occasionally get closing transactions that there are credits coming from different places. Those credits can be that the seller owes you something. It can sometimes be that the lender is passing on a credit to you that offsets some of your closing costs. What are some of the credits that you might see on your closing statement, Carrie?
You could have a tax proration where you're closing in the middle of the year. So the seller is crediting you the amount of taxes for the time that they lived in the house.
That's right. In the states we live in, taxes are collected at the end of the period for the previous period. So in South Carolina, for instance, our property taxes get paid in December, and you're actually paying the taxes that began the previous January. So if your closing is in July, your seller owes you 6.5, 7 months worth of the property taxes because they've lived in the house for that long in the tax year. You'll pay the full tax bill at the end of the year, but they will have credited you with their portion of it. What other types of credits might come up?
There could be, in the same vein, the HOA due proration.
That's right. So, for instance, if homeowners' dues are due and you have to pay a full month, the seller might owe you a half a month of homeowner association dues. You also can, if you choose to close after the first of the month, as we talked about, instead of paying all that interim interest, within the first 3 to 5 days, you can actually choose to close, get a small interim interest credit, and you have your first payment the very next month in the 30-day period. And also, lender credits can come through on your transaction. Lender credits are generated through the selection of your interest rate. Sometimes if your closing costs are too much for you to pay out of pocket, your seller's not paying them, the lender might help you by taking your rate, increasing the rate, and being paid a yield premium for that higher rate, and letting you use the yield premium to pay some of your closing costs.
So that's kind of just like the opposite of a discount point.
That's right. That's really true. A yield premium is the opposite of a discount point. You pay discount points to get a lower rate. You may accept a higher rate to generate a credit that can be used to pay some of your closing costs. Now, before we stop on all of your closing costs, let's talk about some items that can come up that you're not going to see on your LE or used to see on your GFE or your fee sheet or whatever, because they are charges you might encounter, but they're not loan-related expenses. What are some of those items, Kerry, that you have to watch out for? Things that you might be involved in your transaction, but they don't have anything to do with your loan, so your loan officer would not have told you about them.
Any inspection fees, home inspection, termite inspection, radon inspection.
That's right. All your home inspections, there actually are no lender requirements for those anymore, except with VA, who requires a termite letter. But apart from that, a home inspection is not required by a lender. So if you choose to do a home inspection, you'll be paying for that at closing. It's not a loan item, but it may be billed to you and show up on your closing statement. You also have to watch with condominium transactions that there can be a number of different condominium-related fees that, again, are not loan-related. Those might be HOA capital fees. Sometimes when you buy into a condominium complex, you have to pony up some capital fees for future repairs. And there can be dues that are collected in advance. There are even these fees called HOA transfer fees, which I think are just an excuse to charge somebody to change from one owner to the next. Mm-hmm. But they do show up, and you do need to look out for those. If you're purchasing a home, you should ask your realtor if there are any non-loan-related expenses that you might encounter in your transaction so you can budget for those and know what you're getting into. Now, some of the closing costs that we've talked about will affect your APR. Before we get into what those are, let's talk about what APR is. APR, to me, is probably the most confusing thing ever invented, probably with the best of intentions, but I just find that usually our borrowers' eyes glaze over when I try to explain what it is. APR was an attempt to disclose that not all interest rates that are quoted are the same. So, for instance, you could have two lenders quoting you a 4.5% rate, but one might have an APR that is much higher. And the APR would indicate to you which of the two lenders is giving you the best rate in the end, because APR, which stands for annual percentage rate, takes certain of your closing costs, spreads them out over the life of the loan, and treats those as interest charges to your loan. Your APR is always higher than your note rate because you will always have closing costs on your loan. Some of those closing costs are going to go into your APR calculation. It is your base interest rate that determines what your payment is. Your APR has nothing to do with your monthly payment. What your APR does show you is the impact of your closing costs when you spread them out over the life of the loan. The items that affect APR are any origination charges, which would include discount points and origination fees and underwriting fees, and also the closing fee from the attorney or the title company that closes your loan. You can use APR to compare the rate you get. It's always the best gauge of your choice in lending, but can also be a point of confusion. Stretch. You're with Mark and Kerry of Preferred Financial Services. Kerry, let our listeners know again how they can contact us if they have a specific question about the mortgage process.
Give us a call Monday through Friday at 864-235-9596, or you can email us at themortgagemoment@gmail.com.
Great. Thanks, Kerry. We want to talk at the end of the session here about interest rates. I noticed that a lot of confusion was generated after the crash because effectively what had been privatized corporations, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, were taken back over by the government. So there was the feeling out there that the government set interest rates. That's actually technically not true, although the government, through the actions of the Federal Reserve, controlled the interest rates for a long time. And we've seen over the last 3 to 6 months, finally, the exiting of the Federal Reserve's actions in the mortgage market. What was happening up to that point, if mortgage rates were increasing, generally the feds would intervene, purchase mortgage bonds, effectively buying the rates back down by their market actions. We had a very manipulated, very falsified market. You really could not tell where interest rates were going because it just was determined by who woke up that morning and decided how to buy enough bonds through the Federal Reserve to control the rates. But we're getting back to a market-driven rate system, but there's still the illusion that somehow, well, if I get an FHA loan, that's a government loan, so the government's setting the rate. Or if I do a VA loan, the Veterans Administration must set rates. Or Fannie and Freddie, which are government corporations, they set the rates. But, Carrie, none of that's true, is it?
No.
No, it's not. All interest rates are set by free market forces. And I have to say that with quotation marks, free market, because it was not a free market while the feds were intervening in it. But as they have exited, we're getting back to real market rates. Now, the result of that is over the last few months, really since around end of November, rates have been increasing. And I think that's an indication that before that, we were buying rates down very artificially. We're beginning to find some market traction again where rates respond to the things that they used to respond to, which are basically movements of money in and out of the stock and the bond markets. Rates are determined by the market in that the clearinghouses through which loans are ultimately funded, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac, they sell bonds on the open market. Just like the government might sell a bond, a treasury bond, to raise money that they borrow, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac will borrow money by issuing bonds. And those bonds, they have to have an attractive enough rate to attract investors, or they can't sell any bonds and they're not in business. So if the Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac issue a bond, the market will say, okay, how safe is this bond? And traditionally, Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac bonds have been considered the second safest investment item other than a U.S. Treasury bill. In other words, there's a lot of confidence that the return on a Fannie or Freddie bond is going to be what it has stated that it will be. There's no record of Fannie and Freddie bonds ever having been defaulted on. And so they're considered very safe. So they go into the market, they issue those bonds, they sell at slightly higher rates than treasury bonds, but it is the rates at which those bonds are sold that ultimately filters down to the interest rate that you get. So it is a market phenomenon. Rates do change every day. And Carrie, sometimes we have trouble with that. We'll quote someone a rate in the morning, and by the time we get to the afternoon, it's not there. How do we protect the borrowers in a volatile rate environment?
Well, we do that by locking in your loan as soon as possible.
That's right. And does a lock cost them anything?
No, it's absolutely free.
So I would say to everyone out there, if you're not dealing with us, because our policy is when we quote it and you say go, we lock it. That way we can guarantee the delivery of that rate. But I can tell you any number of people who have come into my office screaming and crying because they did not lock their rate with the lender that they chose, and that rate got away from them. I would recommend if you are entering into a transaction, I can't think of any reason to not lock a rate. It's kind of playing Russian roulette if you think, well, I'm going to wait and maybe rates will get a little bit better. I will tell you from 29 years of watching the markets, rates come down very, very slowly. They go up so fast it will make your head spin. I have seen it take years to get interest rates down 1%, but I have seen them go up 1% in a matter of 2 or 3 weeks. So your safest course, if you're buying a house, you know, if you're refinancing, whatever you're doing, request that your rate be locked in and get the confirmation that it is locked in so you're protected. Now, in the good old days, Carrie, Everybody got the same rate. When somebody called me on the phone and said, hey, what's your 30-year fixed rate? I said, well, it's 4% today. Because as long as you were approved to get the loan, you got the same rate no matter what your credit score was, no matter what anything was. There were just no, everybody got the same rate. That changed drastically after the crash. So now, Carrie, we've got all kinds of things that can affect a borrower's interest rate. What would you say is the single most important factor in what rate a person gets?
Your credit score, for sure.
That is the driver. There are credit score adjustments in all programs. Sometimes people will say, okay, is there some point at which there's no more advantage at having a higher score? Where's that threshold, Carrie?
At 740.
Yeah, if you have a 740 or higher score, the or higher doesn't make much difference. Well, it doesn't make any difference.
Unless you're on a jumbo loan, that is.
That's true. Jumbo categories will go on up to 800. Your scores above 740 can help you significantly with what we call lender-paid PMI or no monthly PMI programs. But as far as your base rate that you get from Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, as long as you're 740 or higher, you're in the same category. But below 740, there are increments at which your credit score might change. What are those increments, Carrie?
They're about 20-point increments until you get to the 740 mark.
That's right. So, for instance, if your score is between 620 and 640, you get one rate. But if it's between 641 and 660, it's another rate. And in 20-point increments, that rate can change. And it can be a fairly significant difference. For instance, Carrie, we had a 620 score borrower who was trying to do a conventional loan, and we stacked them up against a 740 borrower. What would the interest rate difference be that they might see?
Oh, gosh, it could be at least a half a point.
Yeah, and usually, depending on the loan-to-value, it can even be as high as three-quarters of a point, even pushing 1% if there's some other factors like a cash-out transaction that would affect the interest rate. So credit score is critical. Now, we counsel with all our borrowers. Sometimes there are things we see that can immediately increase their scores, and we help them with that. We can rescore their bureau, as we mentioned earlier. And although it's an expense, it can be worth it to save you a lot of money over the long haul. So we always look and see if there's anything we can do to immediately improve credit scores. But typically, improving credit scores is a long process. It's a process of a history of good credit. So we encourage everyone out there, watch your credit, watch how you manage your credit, particularly your revolving credit, because it affects the cost of your borrowing, and that spread out over a 20 to 30 year period. Credit scores with FHA, VA, and USDA are a little bit different. They usually have a 680 point at which their rates are not adjusted. But again, credit score is critical in those. There's some other things, Carrie, that can affect a person's interest rate that aren't connected to credit scores. What might some of those be?
Your property type is a big one.
Okay, and we talked about that last week. Whether you're buying a single-family residence or a condominium can make a rate difference. Whether you're buying a single-family residence or a duplex can make a difference. So that type of property type can make a difference in your rate. But there are also the other property types we talked about last week that can affect your rate. That can be whether the house you're purchasing is going to be your primary residence or is a second home or is rental property. So your property types can affect your interest rate. What other things can affect a borrower's interest rate?
If you're doing a purchase or a rate term refinance or a cash out refinance.
Okay, and tell us what a rate and term refinance is. That's a term we toss around, but I find out people don't usually know what that means.
Just when you refinance without the purpose of taking money out, you just want to pay off your current loan to decrease your rate and payments.
Okay, and can people, when they're doing a rate and term refinance, include enough in the loan to pay all their closing costs, or is that cash out when they do that?
Absolutely. They can pay off their closing costs. As long as they don't get more than $2,000 back in the transaction, it's considered a rate term.
That's right. So a rate and term refinance is actually priced at the same interest rate and score differential as a purchase transaction. But when we get to cash out, there's an additional adjustment and there's a higher rate for that same dollar transaction. Why is that, Carrie? Why do we have an additional rate for a cash out transaction?
Cash outs are seen to be a riskier transaction.
And that's what we have here. And all that we're describing is we went from basically a one size fits all category prior to the crash to a very specific risk assessed pricing in the mortgage market. Now, this can be really good for you. If you've got great credit, you've got more down payment, you're doing regular transactions, you're going to get the best rate. And that wasn't true before. You might have been lumped in with the 620 guy who was careless with his credit. And in fact, people used to say to me all the time, well, why don't I get a better rate? Because I got better credit. Now I have people saying, why don't I get as good a rate as somebody else? Well, we have gone to a risk-based pricing, and you do benefit from all the positives. You get hit by the negatives. There are a couple of other things that might affect your rate pricing. Carrie, sometimes when we're refinancing someone, they want to leave an equity line in place. And there's a term in the industry for that that we use.
That is subordinated financing.
And it's subordinated because here's the thing about a mortgage. When you think you have a first mortgage, it's not a first mortgage because it's bigger. It's a first mortgage because it got recorded first.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have a second mortgage, which is usually an equity line or a product like that, it's not a second mortgage because it's smaller. It's recorded second. And if you pay off the first, it moves up. So if you're going to refinance and hold on to an equity line, the equity line lender has to be willing to subordinate it and put it back in its second place. And there is a rate charge for doing that. Loan sizes can affect your rate. All lenders are different. Call us and we can give you specific quotes on your purchase or your refinance. Thanks for being with us today, and we'll see you next week.